Hello, everyone. My name is Devin Rue. I'm a professional fantasy cartographer and illustrator in the tabletop RPG industry, as well as your host for the Quip and Quill podcast.
My name is Bertie Lane, and I am a full-time in-house writer and editor and game designer at Hit Point Press. Up here in Canada, you might have know me from things like Humblewood, Hecna, Fool's Gold, the book version, not the YouTube show, but the kind of book translation of the YouTube show by Dingo Doodles. I've also worked on the animated tarot, done a bunch of things pretty much all in-house with Hit Point Press. You can also find me at my own website, veritylane.com. That's Lane like street, L-A-N-E. That's me.
Nice. I actually sort of almost, I have credits for the Humblewood book that technically I felt were I shouldn't have had.
That must have been before I joined. Can you, like, joined Hit Point? Can you tell me about that?
So I was contacted by Hit Point Press to do some work for them on the book. And I said, great. You know, we've been having a conversation. I said, you know, anytime that you want to work with me, I'd absolutely love to. And then I was brought on, not for a map, but for illustrations and stuff. And I was like, okay, which is fine. Just wasn't what I was expecting. And then we kind of like kept going like back and forth. And it was just like really off timing.
Yeah.
I had other projects. They had a ton of stuff going on. And then I was a little confused because the art direction wasn't what I was used to. And I was like, I'm not sure what you're asking me to draw here.
I think that was before I joined the company, and like Humblewood was such a like unexpected success.
Yeah.
That really like Hit Point like formed around it, and like we have learned so much, which is another way of saying we have made many mistakes. But yeah, like I wasn't there for like the Humblewood 1. Right. I'm like working a lot on Humblewood 2. I worked a lot on Humblewood Tales. And I think we have slightly got our act together with art direction. We have an art director full time now.
That would help.
That helps, yeah.
Yeah.
The wonderful Brian is taking care of these things.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I thought it was, and it was great. And it was funny because, they messaged me and was like, you know, we still want to credit you in the book. I was like, you don't have to. Like, I like did like literally a 15-minute drawing, and then we kind of like went back and forth, and then I did a draft, and that was like, I did so little. And they're like, no, you worked on the book. I was like, but I kind of didn't.
I feel like because like pretty much everyone at Hit Point like comes from like either an artist background or like graphic design background, or like we have people from like the world of animation, and like I think there's this really strong like pro artist kind of attitude where it's like we want people to know, we want people to get the credit. Like we've started putting the artist credits on their pieces, like in the gutter on the book, because like when you pick up an RPG book and you're like you see an amazing piece of art and you're like, damn, who did this? I want them to do art for me. And like trying to track people down sometimes is really hard. And like we love the artists that we work with, and so we're like, we want them to get lots of work. And people should know that they're like, who did this thing? And yeah, just like really a sense of kind of like we're very pro artist. just in general, I think that's kind of one of the reputations that the company has. In terms of like we put our budget into our art, we get the art. that's just like so stunning, and we're like, whenever it comes in, like all the rest of the team is just like big star eyes, like, oh my god.
Oh yeah, like it. I love Humblewood, absolutely love it. It is actually everything that you guys pretty much put out that I love. But Humblewood is the one that me and my group play when we only want to do, like, when our regular campaign has a pause in it, or I have less players than normal, or we're playing a few sessions to try out a new player at our table. We will almost always play a Humblewood game, just because. Mostly because we get to be creatures and the art's just gorgeous.
That makes me so happy to hear. Like, yeah, like, as I said, I didn't work on Humblewood 1. I am also a massive fan of Humblewood. Like, when I joined, I was just like, you mean I get to, like, work on cute little critters and their various exciting adventures? Yes, please.
Right? I mean, like, oh, you know, and the best thing is, like, you know, every time that I bring anyone new to my table, I always want to do something really nice and lighthearted. Like, let's not, you know, not that any of our Humblewood games are, I don't know if I would consider them technically lighthearted anymore, but that's the idea that we have when we go into it. It's just not what happens once we start playing. Cause
like, yeah, the, like when we at the moment we're working on Humblewood 2, and we've had a lot of meetings with like writers we want to bring on to the project. And like, mm-hmm. when we're talking about the like theme and the mood of Humblewood 2, we often talk about it in terms of like, children's literature, but it's, like, it's not for children, but like children's literature in the sense of like big things happen in kids' books, like big, right. dark things, like scary, horrible, terrible things,
right.
happen
like
in
grim
kids'
fairy
books.
Tales.
Yeah, like right. it's for kids. That means it's way scarier than stuff for adults. like
basically,
that's kind of the vibe. Like those books that you read as a kid and were dealing with like big good and evil kind of complex things, and like learning to kind of teach you how to be a person and deal with things in your actual life, but also cute little animals, kind of all packaged up. And I think right. that's one of our like touchstones for Humblewood. I have heard it described as like one of the grimmest settings.
I mean,
some people really think it's very dark. But it's got coziness there too.
It is. It's. I made the joke. Well, actually, my player summed it up best. She said it's like we were playing Mothership Down, mm-hmm. and yeah. I was like, "Oh, don't say that. You know, like, please don't, because yeah, I'm scarred for life from that show."
Yeah, like animals. I think like they have this like really. These resonances for us, like through like the stories that we tell when we're kids, through things like Woodship Down, and but you get to explore like really big and heavy themes.
Yeah.
But also you get to like, oh, I'm drinking out of an acorn.
You know, get to be cute while you're doing it.
Yeah, and I just love it. It's great.
Yeah. So yeah, so no, that's awesome. So what exactly do you do?
So I am. Mostly write and edit, and my like how much of my work is writing versus editing depends on like where things are in the project. Mm-hmm. So I have my fingers in many pies. I wear many hats because that's right. There's I also do a bit of project management. I run our Patreon. I like sort of. Someone needs some words, I will words them for them.
Gotcha.
kind of in-house words doer.
Well, because the company's still really small, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're like maybe like 10, around like 13, 14 people at the moment. I'd have to count us up. I think we punch above our weight.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people like it's a huge company, you know. I don't think so. I think there's only like, you know, 10 people working there.
Yeah, like we're all sort of wearing all the hats and running around trying to pull this thing off. Not a huge, we are not Wizards of the Coast.
Right.
But
well,
we
you're
are
doing
trying to-
brilliantly.
yeah, we're like, we want to do better. We want to do really, really well. But yeah, with our little team.
Oh, that is awesome. So, how did you get started with the company?
So before TTRPG, I was not doing anything of the kind. Okay. I used to work at the Japanese embassy here in Ottawa, where there are many embassies because it is Canada's capital city. Right. And prior to that, I'd lived and worked in Japan for quite a few years. And so I was doing that. And then I didn't want to be doing that anymore. The it's hard doing a Japanese work ethic job outside of Japan. It makes slightly more sense in Japan, still very hard. Right. I got kind of unwell, and like spent a lot of time feeling not great. And so I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll go back to school because that's always a great idea. And so I went off and I did a degree in psychology. And also worked out that the reason I was feeling unwell is that I developed a absolutely terrible lactose allergy. I wasn't dying, which was nice, but it was just like, this is a really difficult time, kind of like health stuff and blah, 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 and I was like, oh, I don't want to do this. But the one thing that was like absolutely like my rock during that time was that I played D&D like at my local game cafe. Mm-hmm. And I had been playing there like basically since I moved to Canada. And I was just like, this is the highlight of my week. This is the thing that is like keeping me going. And and then our DM moved to Toronto because everyone moves to Toronto, unless they work for the government in Ottawa, basically. It's just kind of classic Ottawa problems. And I was like, I don't want this to stop. I'm going to step up and I'll be the DM. Nice. So, and also I was like, ah, ha, 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 I have plans. I want to be the DM and do like create chaos for my friends. And so I was running games at the game cafe. Shout out to The Loft in Ottawa. It's fantastic board game / video game eatery. It's a really great place. They ran like lots of tables on a Wednesday night, and one of the other tables was being run by Jordan, who is now my boss. He doesn't like it when I call him my boss. He's like, no, I'm not your boss. And I'm like, yeah, no, you're my boss. He's the like head of the writing and content department.
Gotcha.
So that's why I like winding him up. Anyway, so he was also running games there, and that's how we kind of got to know each other and became friends. And he also was then, I like pressured my husband into playing, and then Jordan was my husband's DM. so that was fun. And then I saw just a job posting that Hitpoint was looking for a like writer, editor person, and I applied. And of course, being massively socially anxious, I did not say to my friend Jordan, hey, I'm applying, or do anything like that. I was just like, I'm just going to do this because I wanted to see if they would like me based on my application. Right. And yeah, that's how I ended up doing my very cool job, which I never thought that I would get to do because I didn't really know that it existed until... like the past like 5 years, I guess.
I always say that, you know, when I went to career day as a kid in school, fantasy cartography was never mentioned. Like, yeah. I didn't know you could do this for a living. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Like I played D&D back in college the first time around, right. Like back in kind of 2007-ish. So of course we were playing fourth edition, and right. it was just like, even then it was just like, yeah, this is the greatest thing ever. but like, I didn't think that was something that I could like work in, partly because at the time I was living in the UK, like it seemed like very far away, kind of in North America, or even not even North America, like specifically in the States, that like a lot of the stuff was going on. And there are a few British kind of companies, but like, again, pretty small. And I think it's really great now that like things are like widening out and like being more global. And that like there can be a Canadian TTRPG company that's doing okay. And let alone like people from all across other parts of the world. It's just really nice to see what people are doing and get to enjoy their cool games.
Yeah, absolutely. That must be amazing to hear about other people's games, knowing that you have like have a hand in their storytelling and what they do and how they enjoy their table.
We had someone like let us know that they played like 50 sessions of Humblewood, and they were just like, they clearly like put in so much of their own like passion into it, and they were like describing all the amazing things that they'd done, and it was just like, oh my god, this is so cool. like this is all you. Like we didn't get you to play 50 sessions of this game in like a year. But like you have really like taken this and made it your own. But it was so cool to just hear how much it had affected like all the people at their table and like how deeply invested people had got. It's always absolutely wild. I love when people tell us their like table stories. I'm just like, yes, give it to me. I want to know how you dealt with like the problems that we set up for you.
Right. Do you play Humblewood?
I've played Humblewood. I don't have a current active like campaign in Humblewood, which is kind of a bummer. although I think like we've been talking about kind of trying to set up a work kind of play test so we can get away with playing at work. kind of testing out some of our newer things. I'd like to do that. That would be really fun.
Would
and
you
also
DM?
Useful. Maybe. It would probably trade off between me and Jordan. Or maybe we just hand the stuff we made to someone else and see what they make of it, because that's the big thing. Like, we're not, it's fine for us to write something that we understand, but it's like writing something for someone else to understand. That's the big kind of challenge. Like when I run my own games, I am an improviser. I do not prep terribly hard. I'll like write one prophecy and then sail on that for like 6 months. there's a huge difference between that kind of prepping for your home game and then like, okay, I'm writing something for someone to read to then deliver to someone else through improvisation and their own kind of take on it. And you're like trying to think like of like three minds away from your own mind and making sure that the things that they need to know are there and the feeling that you want them to have gets through. And so it's like a huge kind of gulf between that. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about, especially the editing phase where it's like, okay, we've got this cool idea. How do we make it as dreamlined as possible to like get it into the GM's hands and then into the players' brains through the GM and make sure that the GM has what they need to do to get the cool moment, to have the cool feeling.
We have so many people who listen to this that all five of them who I say that, but you know, because I'm terrified to look at the number, so I'm hoping it's more than that. But I know it is because I get questions. So I end up with a lot of people who are writing their own campaign books and stories and everything else that they want to publish out there. And I will always absolutely emphasize hiring editors, because as much as I don't care how good of a writer you are still you still think that you're writing what is playing through your head
mm-hmm.
does not mean that that's actually what's coming out on the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, yes.
Yeah. And even when you reread it, it's still, again, it's the words that's playing in your head. So editors are extremely important. Do you have anything specific that you would offer to people who are like, you know, advice for writing their own campaign books? Or hiring an editor, for that matter.
Yeah, first of all, hire an editor. Best money you've ever spent. Like, as you said, you can't see your own you can't see through the veil of your own knowledge of what you're putting on the page. You can't see the gaps that you've left because you know what fills them. And having someone say, "Hey, I don't get this," or "Hey, did you really mean this?" is very, very helpful. And that's aside from all of the kind of like more like technical writing aspects, where it's like if you're writing within a game system, you need to make sure that it actually works with that game system and it follows all the conventions. An editor is the person to get you there. Like when I write things, I am always asking for, like, please give me the critique. Please, please, please. I want this to be the best thing it can be. And seeing an editor's role and taking an editor's feedback in that spirit of, I want this to be the best it can be, and this person is going to help me get there, is mm-hmm. so important. That is just absolutely, like, just putting the polish on everything. And so the people can actually enjoy your cool ideas. Because right. I think everyone has, like, I genuinely believe that, like, everyone is creative. Like, everyone has really cool ideas. Everyone has something to share. And it's just finding the best way to share it. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, like, practicality of actually expressing that into the world that we all need some help with. Like, because it's going from your own head into someone else's head. Like, naturally, you need to have someone, like, be the head that you test that connection out on.
Right.
And that's your editor, right? And then for just, like starting to start a project and consider what you want to put into it, like, the thing that I find has really, really helped is... first of all, like, thinking about your audience, like, who is your reader? Because you can't please everyone, but you can please, like, someone who really loves the same, like, super weird, super specific thing that you love. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, I just want sentient bread to, like, go on a little adventure. Great. That's a cool... idea. You just have to find your way. So, like, be weird. I love weird stuff that people do. But then you also have to be kind of ruthless. And this again is kind of one of my roles at Hit Point, is to be the person who cuts things, who says no. Because when you you can start a project and you could just, like, go on and on and build out and out and just, like, create something so huge, but that's not necessarily going to, like, get your idea across to other people. And maybe that's not what you want. If you're just doing it for your own own enjoyment, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Like, that's great. I love that kind of stuff. But if you're trying to, like, get something published, pitch it to a publisher, then you have to start thinking a little bit about, like, okay, who's the audience here? And then you have to be kind to your audience. And so that means organizing your information really carefully. So you make it, like, before you start writing, you make yourself a template. And you're like, I'm going to make sure that, like, all of my settlements will follow roughly this template. And I can tweak that template if I need to. Like, maybe this place has, like, it doesn't have a one single leader. They have, like, a council. And now I'm not going to do a write-up of the leader. I'll do a... like, summary of all of these council members and their various feuds. But having that template means that, like, you're taking some of the pressure off the reader to have to know what they're about to read. they can get at your information more easily. So I'm a huge fan of templates. They're actually pretty hard to put together. Like, you think like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But then it's like, as soon as you start writing, you're like, actually, no, this doesn't work. And you have to like rework it. But then making sure you have that consistency, and just really keeping that kind of organizational thing all the way through. That's what I look at most of my time at work. And so that's obviously what I kind of focus on.
So when you're writing like a campaign book, and you want to keep templates and everything else, is there, well, one, are there any tools that kind of help with that? Or would it be easier to hire someone else that helps you do that? Like, what's the best way? Because I absolutely love the idea that you just said, be kind to your audience. Because as somebody who, I have a fantastic memory, and every time I read something, I just can't forget it. And I don't want to ever bash an author, but I had read a book once where so much of it, it sounded like at least 20 different people wrote this book, and none of them had anything in common. And I hated it because I couldn't follow along particular things. I couldn't really figure out like what the connection was supposed to be, you know, like between characters or between scenes and everything. So I love the idea that, hey, stay organized. But like how on earth would you do that? Especially if you don't know how to create a template or even knew that this is something you should be doing.
So I think one thing you can do is like, stealing is always a good idea. If there is a book you really like and it you find really engaging and interesting, take another look at it and see how they're presenting the information. Not just what they're presenting, but like how are they doing it? Are they using headings? Like, do they have text boxes? Do they have are they like linking their images and their words like in a really nice way? Steal with abandon, like and look at lots of different kind of sources as well, because you can then take your kind of mushy ideas that are all just in a big fun soup, and you can start thinking, okay, how will I like, what are the parts of this that I can slot into maybe some categories? And then when I say a template, it's like, I just work in Google Docs. I don't have any of the kind of fancy screenwriting or novel writing softwares. But I also have, and this is kind of more specific to TTRPG, I also have a spreadsheet for all of the content that goes into each of our books. So when I'm building out the template, that'll be kind of a series of headings, and it'll note sort of what should go into each of these things roughly. It'll be like circa 150 words on environment of location or whatever. And then the spreadsheet, that's where anything mechanical gets recorded. So that's the, like, all your monsters, all your items, all your spells, all your classes, subclasses, anything else that you're doing of that type, and all of their kind of like basic information. So like, for example, for like a 5e book, I'll have like, here's a huge list of all of the monsters, here's like their CR, their size, their type, and then that's also often where I link up with the art department, and now we have this list, and so we can start talking about art, and we're not going to accidentally miss the Groggle Flax or whatever. I'm like, oh no, 6 months from now, we didn't get any art for the Groggle Flax. Panic.
Right?
Yeah, and also, I know how to spell Groggle Flax, because the spell checker sure doesn't know how to spell Groggle Flax.
On your own.
Yeah, and so when you've got this list, when you've got it there, like way at the other end of the project, when you're doing Control F Groggle Flax, and you're checking that you haven't spelled it wrong anywhere throughout the entire book, it's super useful to have. Or if someone's name changes, like I have seen books where a character's name changes halfway through, and I'm like, ooh, oh dear.
Right. That must be fun for editing. Oh.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. I'm like, now we need to pick which name is the right one. But yeah, just like when you're working on projects of kind of like a scale of a book, you need to put your brain onto a piece of paper. And by piece of paper, I mean a computer.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone who listens knows that I desperately want to talk about Legend Keeper here.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just going to say this would be perfect for that.
Yeah, we do have an internal wiki which kind of does, and I'm going to say, yeah, it is pretty useful. Like, right? I have read through Humblewood so many times. I have soaked myself in it, like, utterly. And even I am just like, which is the Amaranthine of, what's their name? And, like, it's just so useful to be able to look up, like, something and just be, like, certain. It's like, yes, it's worth having it so you can be certain. And so that you, an editor doesn't have to fix it when you come back through at the end.
Right. I was going to say, it would be so much easier bringing people on a project if you have it that organized.
Yeah, I went to a conference, it was a science fiction and fantasy writers conference, and there was this fantastic panel with people who had been who wrote for IP, so they're like writing for like Stranger Things and stuff, like, and they were talking about the process and the their experience of doing it. And they all said, like, having a really organized, like, kind of show Bible was really useful. And I was like, ah, we should do that. We should have one of those. And so I went away and made one for us. Because, yeah, and now we've been able to just hand over this wiki to writers so that they don't have to ask us. They can just find the information they need. Right. Hopefully easily. I'm fingers crossed it's kind of getting tested out at the moment. but yeah, like, especially if you're collaborating with other people, making sure that everyone's on the same page is so big. It's so huge.
Do you hand your writers like a style sheet or a template, or do you just let them have fun and whatever they come up with, then you edit it? Like,
I hope they have fun, but yeah, I do. We do hand them templates and style sheets because, as you said, like when a book feels like it's been written by lots of different people. I mean, they are written by lots of different people, and we want that. Like, we want different perspectives, and we really want like a breadth of experience to like inform these books. But it has to like work together as a whole. And so at the moment we've got some really great folks working on like the setting guide for Humblewood 2, and we want them to like work to roughly the same template so that, as I said, like when you're reading it through, you're not like, well, why is there a section about festivals here and not over here? What are the festivals in that region or whatever? So that there is just that kind of sense of consistency. And then within that template, they can kind of go wild and have fun. We do also have a style sheet, which, like, it just... there's, like, D&D writing in particular is so technical.
Yes.
I don't think... Yeah, it's so, so technical. It's like, this has to be capitalized, but not this. Like, you have to have a hyphen between this number and this word and like 50 feet versus 50 foot. And like, and we want to get those things right. And the more we can get right sooner, the less time it takes the editors like at the back end of the project. So yeah, we do have this big style sheet. It also has like, we also, cause we use Google Docs and InDesign. This is my top trick, which I'm very, this is my top secret, my top trick. Probably other people who actually know about graphic design know a better way of doing this, but if you format all of your documents like correctly, so you've got like all your italics are italics and all your bold is bold and all your headings, you use like a color. When you, if you download your text into a program like Word or Pages, And then you copy the text from there into InDesign, it will preserve that formatting, and you can just Control F, find color, replace, and it formats all your headings correctly. And it formats all your italics correctly. And so you don't have to have some like beleaguered graphic designer going through and like re-italicizing every single italic in like a 250 page book. There's probably a better way of doing it, and if anyone knows, I would love to know, but that's the way we've worked out how to do it, and so that's another reason why we're like, we need you to follow these conventions, like your heading two has to be blue. Like, please do it, like it's all set up for you, the document is all ready, just hit click heading two, it'll work.
I don't use InDesign, that program scares me.
It's a program that I've only learned since joining HitPoint Press, like, and it's like the parts of it that I play with I'm kind of happy with, but then I just like look over at our graphic designer just doing magic and I'm just like, right? how are you doing this? What is going on? Please just make it beautiful, thank you. I just do the words. I just make words be words. It's fine.
Right. So how would one get HitPoint Press's attention, or like how do you all find your writers?
So we do have like if someone's got like a project that they want to pitch to us, I believe we have a form on our website. Because I definitely, like, I've read through things that people have pitched to us and that we have taken on and are publishing. So yeah, we are like we are open to things, and that's also like the same for like artists. Like we have a link on our website. I think it's in our like about page to like send a portfolio and. Yeah, so that's like one way, like contact us directly if you've got a cool idea. And I think we have like a form that you can fill out so that we're getting the information from you that we need. Mm-hmm. And then for writers, so we used to have a project which I sort of helmed for a while called The Big Bads, which I loved because it basically like each issue was like a little zine with like one boss monster. Mm-hmm. And for that, I like some of the people were like people we knew in the industry. And then sometimes I just go onto Twitter and I'm like, who's written about TTRPGs? And then I would go to their portfolio and I would just snoop around and kind of just take a look and see what people are out there doing stuff. And then I could contact them and say, hey, do you want to write us a boss monster? And that was really fun to get to like work with like a ton of different writers. Like I think we had 50 issues. So we just like, and then from there, like writers that we really liked from that project were like, well, yeah, please come back, write with us some more. And I'm hoping we'll have something else like that in the future. We got to 50 issues and we were like, okay, we're good. But yeah, like you can contact us directly. Like it's with art. I know Brian, our art director, he does a lot of portfolio reviews, like at various kind of art shows and things. Mm-hmm. He's pretty active, like out there. And like, if you get the chance to go get Brian to see your portfolio, definitely take it because he's great. He's very kind and he's very nice. So yeah, you can just get in contact with us. We're not too scary.
Well, I think that most artists assume that, oh, you know, they already have writers or else they would post about it. And like, I same with writers. I think it's so, I do stress that, you know, absolutely put your stuff out there because you never know who's looking at your profiles. Mm-hmm. So it's always good to hear that, you know, we have people actively looking for them. But yeah, I think a lot of us are terrified because it's like, oh, well, you already have a book. You already have writers, you know, like, you know, and, yeah,
we like new projects. We like new writers. It's like, we're always on the lookout for people. Because yeah, it's like, again, like different voices, different perspectives. That's one of our like big things that we really want to be part of in the scene, mm-hmm. is like making sure that we're getting a bunch of like different people having right. a chance to share their stuff, because it just makes the whole GTRPG scene better for everyone.
Do you all do anything that's not specifically D&D or 5th edition?
So we're actually developing our own game system at the moment, nice. which is called Shift. Our beta is like, I think it's free on our website at the moment, but there's lots of rumblings behind the scenes about the full release. Gotcha. So yeah, Shift is really fun because it's very like tinkerer friendly. Like if you enjoy getting weird and getting like playing with the tools of a TTRPG and building something that's just right for you, I feel like that's what Shift is really good for. Because it just opens up things. It's not kind of from a list of spells, pick a class. It's very sort of bespoke. pick your attributes yourself.
Yeah, I do that with my players. I'll endlessly talk about them because they're fantastic. But you know, one of the things that I've always greatly disliked about specifically D&D is the fact that like you're kind of like put into, like, if you're without multiclassing, if you're a bard, you're a bard, and apparently nobody else can sing, be inspirational, or play musical instruments that have any effect, you know.
So yeah,
we kind of changed that about our game, because I was like, oh no, because I have, you know, that we had a lute playing. Oh, I think there were a paladin. And so we gave him songs and stuff that he could sing and play, and could inspire each other or just be goofy. And, you know,
I love that.
Yeah,
that's a really great vibe. And it's like, yeah, tinkering and making it your own is like, I think, part of TTRPGs. Like every table plays differently. And so, yeah, like a system that is kind of designed with that in mind is pretty fun. We've published a few indie games, If I Were a Lich Man by Lucian Kahn, which is absolutely fantastic.
I love the name alone.
Yeah, highly recommend. I think the box set has tiny dreidel die. It's amazing. Oh. And yeah, it's really wonderful. And indie games and like kind of beyond D&D is definitely a thing that we're kind of interested in being part of, and like creating and helping other people who have created them like get it out to a wider audience.
If somebody came to you with a project and, you know, maybe they have their own system and it requires specific dice, I love the idea that someone has dreidel dice, and how much is of that is like, okay, we're going to take this on as our company, how much of it is like we're just going to work around whatever the creator presents to us? Like, do you know what I'm asking? How much of it? Yeah.
So it depends on the different project. Mm-hmm. We've done things where basically someone's just come to us and like fully fleshed out, here's the whole thing, let's go, and we're like, cool, we'll do support for you, basically. Like, we'll help you with the Kickstarter, we'll help you with the marketing, we'll help you with the fulfillment, like, that kind of thing. Nice. And then we've also done kind of half and half, like, people have come to us and we've given them advice, like, at an early stage in the writing of a book, and kind of, like, kind of sort of a developmental edit, we call it. So sort of, here's what's really standing out and is great, focus on this, here's what's not working so well, and like you can maybe try and fix it, right. And then so more of a kind of a advisory thing. We've also had, I know we've bought games which we've then taken on and like fully developed ourselves from the initial concept. And then we've had a project like Fool's Gold, where we worked really closely with the creators, and it was kind of like an in-house book, but using an IP from the like creators. And that was so we've kind of done like all the different projects in different ways. And it just depends on like what's needed, what we can offer, like how much bandwidth we have. Because I mean, Fool's Gold was like my life for like a year and a half, basically. And just like that was like almost all of my working time was on that project. And yeah, so that's not something like. We can only do that for one book at a time, right?
Right.
So if someone else had come to us needing that kind of level of involvement, we wouldn't have been able to do it. But yeah, that's kind of the way it breaks out.
Answer this only if you can or want to. How do you even afford that? You know, as somebody who, like, I always have a bazillion ideas. I always have, like, all these projects I want to do. And then I'm like, what if I could bring them to somebody? And then I'm like, how on earth would I even pay for this? How does this work? I do know, obviously, that they, you know, at least Humblewood had a Kickstarter. And that was apparently very successful.
Yeah, it's like Kickstarter is always such a gamble. Like, didn't know Humblewood was gonna go
right
like through the roof. I don't deal a lot with the like business side of things. I will say, I think something to keep in mind is that we are based in Canada. Mm-hmm. We're not paying health insurance premiums, like things like that there, or we are, but they're in a slightly less kind of capitalist hellscape way than maybe in the States. Like there are obviously issues in Canada too. But like, I think we're able to kind of function at the size that we do, like with the projects that we do. And like, I will say I don't have any complaints about Hit Point and kind of like worker exploitation. Like, they take good care of us. And that is, I think, it's rarer than it should be in the industry. I don't fully know how it works, but I'm glad that it does. That's what I will say.
Yeah, because I mean, like, I have Humblewood and everything. It is such a well put together. It looks like a major company created this. It looks like, you know, like you'd expect a huge corporation. Like, and it's so, and not in any way am I putting down like smaller creators and stuff like that, because the budget isn't there to create it, I'm sure, the way that many of them want to. But it is so well put together compared to so many things that we see come out in the space, where it's supposed to be a, you know, like a fully fleshed out campaign guide or setting and everything, and it's just falls slightly short and it's underwhelming. And I remember when I got the box, like I spent like 2 hours just combing through and taking everything out, and I loved it. Mostly because I was floored that such a tiny company made such a well-made product that looked like they had an endless budget to do it.
I think it comes down to the fact that we like really love the things that we make.
Yeah, like, you can tell.
and that we're kind of happy. Like, it's we love this stuff. Like, we genuinely love it. We want it to be the best it can be. I've definitely had days where I'm just like, I have to get this right. Maybe slightly obsessively going in and making sure that every single apostrophe is a curly apostrophe and not a straight apostrophe. Cause I'm like, it's that, that level of polish, that I expect of myself. Like, if I let that go, I'm not gonna be okay. I think just everyone just really cares about it. Like, it's like, yeah, we want to make a good thing and we want people to enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I would be terrified to bring anything to you, especially if I was a smaller creator. I'd be like, no, because clearly you all have a huge, you know, huge company, huge budget.
Nope.
You know, like...
We've worked with like one person doing a thing, and we've worked with like kind of teams of people doing things. I think it is just like the projects that we go for are just the ones that speak to us, and we're like, hell yeah. Like that's really it. If we're hell yeah about a project, then we're gonna make sure it has that kind of Hit Point Press polish on it.
Right. Do you have anything upcoming that you can talk about?
Well, we've got the Field Guide to Floral Dragons is kickstarting at the moment, which is just so gorgeous.
Oh my god.
Yeah, Kinwald, just so beautiful. Most beautiful dragons book. I got to do some writing on that, and then I gave it like the final, kind of like went through and edited it with another editor. And it's just so much fun. Like, did you ever have the like dragonology books as a kid? Like,
yes.
I had those books, and I remember like curling up with them and just kind of imagining dragons. Still obsessed with dragons to this day, just like, oh, I love them. And that kind of feeling is what we tried to go for in the writing of the book, because Kin came to us with like the most beautiful art and these great ideas and all this research about flowers and kind of like the ornithogalum plant sickens livestock, so here's the dragon and it's like sickening these livestock, and so it's like, oh, how do we translate that into like a power? Oh, it has a magical aura, but like it looks kind of like a chill dragon, so it doesn't seem angry. Like maybe it doesn't know why it's doing. Oh, but it has this theme of like innocence and kind of innocent destruction. And we just like went so deep into each of these and like their biology and the lore about them and like plants and dragons. Yeah, it was just so much fun to work on. And now it's really like it's popped off on Kickstarter, like in a way that we were just like not expecting. Like we were pretty sure it would fund because it's absolutely beautiful, but right. Like, oh my goodness, we're just like what? What?
Yeah, that ring, I just wrote myself a note because I completely forgot about it again until you said something, and I was like, oh, that's right, I need to pledge because I need this book.
It's so pretty, and the book and like it's just. It like that's a project which kind of is like an art out project. Like it started with the art, and then we wrote from the art, which is a really fun kind of challenge. Challenge in really the good way, because like you just get to like stare at this art and like pick out the details and take that and like extrapolate and create like a world around it from this absolutely beautiful art. It's great.
How long has the project been going on?
I think it's like 2 years. Like it takes a. I think that's something that people don't really know is how long it takes these books to get put together.
Right.
Like because we ran Floral Dragons like little previews of some of them last year on our Patreon. And then Kin was working on the art like the year before, and the writing started the year before. These books take a long time. 2 years is like a minimum for like a TTRPG book. We've learned so much about just how much time they take, to get them done right. Right.
So that, okay, so I love that you mentioned Patreon. So we talk a lot about Patreon in here and the things that we can, offer patrons and stuff like that, and how hard it is to kind of like keep up with the schedules that we make for ourselves. But I am just absolutely curious how much do your patrons see before like the public does? How much do they have influence? Do they get to go on polls? Like, what, how does Patreon play in any development of books or projects?
So we have, our Patreon has gone through many seasons. originally, when we were kind of mostly focused on cards, like Patreon was a way that we sent out cards, and then we moved into the Big Bads project, and that was just kind of like delivering complete material, which we then have collected into a like a hardback book with extra material later on. But then at the end of last year, I pitched to the company. I was like, hey, we're really winding up on Humblewood 2. I think we should switch the Patreon to be more behind the scenes and more playtest. Because I like, we're doing all this work and I want, and I don't want to wait 2 years to show it up was one of the reasons. And also it's like the feedback that we get is so helpful. Right. And so in January, we switched the Patreon over to be Humblewood 2 playtest. And it's gone pretty well. I think people like it. I hope people like it. We're releasing playtest content, concept art, sketches, and introductory stuff from the book. And that's kind of a lot of mechanical content, because that's the stuff that we like, is super helpful to get feedback on. So new races, subclasses, we've got a new class, the Fizzer, and then we're getting feedback on that, and that is just so helpful, because like as I said, we are a small team. Three or four sets of people looking at something are not going to be as insightful as like hundreds of people looking at something. So it's just really great, and also to like connect with people and hear what they think directly is very like inspiring, and it's very like motivating. Like when you're just having a bad day and you're just like, let me just go check the Patreon. There they are, the people we do it for. And then we have got some polls. Every few months we run a poll to design a mini, because we have an in-house STL sculptor, like mini sculptor, Victoria. Who is just a wizard, a sculpting wizard. And so we've got people to vote for like the race and the class, and then and then we put it together, and Victoria goes away, makes an amazing mini, and she'll often like share some of her kind of like how she made a pose sheet and things like that, and then like record some of the sculpting process, and we cut that down so people can kind of see how it actually works. Right. And then we're hoping to take those minis, and then like it kind of comes back into the writing department, and we'll write out stats for them and kind of make them a little NPC or something, and if we can, we'll try and like fit them into the book. And so yeah, that's a fun kind of way we get to see like what are people interested in. Spoiler, people love the cat folk. People love the allurance. And so we're like, okay, great, we're definitely gonna have like an Allurin Warlock somewhere in here. The Patreon does have influence on like what we're doing at the moment.
Nice. Yeah, I'm always so interested because because I fully believe that like, hey, they're already your audience. Ask them questions about what to put on your Patreon or what they want to see or whatever. And they're a great resource for other things. I do work with other people in the industry, and I think one of the most interesting things to get when it like comes to people who want to make books and writers and everything else is like, I don't know, they don't know why to have a Patreon, other than to like share, you know, bits and pieces of what they're writing. And I was like, there's so much more to it. But
yeah, it's like, it's not a store, right?
Right.
Like, it's not a place when I join Patreons, it's not to get some, like, it is, I mean, there'll be like benefits and things, but it's like right. The connection and the community and like the excitement. Like, if I just want to buy something, I'll just go buy something from a creator I like. Like actually getting to talk to the patrons. We've started live streaming, mm-hmm. which is mildly daunting but quite fun. Getting to chat with folks is really, really fun. We did a live stream last month, yes, mm-hmm. Where we had them vote on a race, and then Jordan and I just made a race from scratch, live.
Nice.
And people voted for bears, and we had a lot of fun talking about bears. And it's like, how do you make a bear person in 5e?
Right.
They had some pretty fun abilities. There was an ability called Bear Snug, where they can share their hit dice. If you cuddle up to them.
Love that.
Yeah.
Do you all have a Discord?
We have our public Discord. We have a company Discord, which is just where we just share GIFs mostly.
I mean, what else do you do on Discord when it's a company? Yeah.
We have a public Discord, which is also very fun. That's where we go and see people say nice things, and we're like, happy.
Yeah, I will make sure I also link to that. Hopefully, some days I just forget. I say it on here, and I'm like, yeah, I'll link to it. And then I'm editing. I even make a note, and then I go to publish it, and I'm like, oh, I've totally blanked. As always, our show is sponsored by Legend Keeper, a fantastic world-building tool whether you're a writer, a GM, DM, or even a player. You can create a world, you can add all of your notes, you can determine who gets to see them, edit them, create their own. And if you own a project, you are the only person who has to have a subscription, so you can bring your players in for free, or your readers, or your patrons. You can determine who can edit, who can see, who can view secrets. And there are so many really interesting tools on Legend Keeper that allow you to link pages, maps, images, sidebars, timelines, calendars, like you name it. There is so much about Legend Keeper that is so simple and yet incredibly effective. Especially with AI, knowing that they can pull things off of videos and stuff like that, I make sure that everything kind of has some sort of branding on it. So
AI is... not something we mess with over at Hitpoint. It is kind of scary.
Oh, just a little bit. Me and several people have been talking about how much work has gone down for a lot of people because AI is more affordable, so to speak.
It's been interesting, on the business side of things, when it's we've been talking contracts with people, mm-hmm. And especially more established people are now during that contract phase saying, hey, is there any AI going to be on this project? And I am so glad that people are asking that question, because we can say, no, and if you look here, it says you're not allowed to use AI either on our projects. But I think that's really important. That especially people who can kind of throw their weight around are saying, I'm not going to work on something if you're like I might be a writer, but you're getting AI art. No, that's not okay. Same. So I respect respect the people who say that, and I'm very glad that we were able to like be on the same page with them.
Yeah, all of my contracts include a clause that if any AI in any capacity is being used, I don't want to be a part of the project, and I will terminate it.
Yeah, yeah.
Until there is some sort of ethical use or some sort of limitations or opt-in or compensation, I can't justify the use of AI.
Nope.
We had talked about, or you had mentioned, like, you know, putting your stuff out there and getting critiqued and everything else. I'm assuming, hopefully. So I know that you said that you worked for the Japanese embassy before you did Hit Point Press, but I'm assuming that you did other writing before that?
Yes. So I have an MA in creative writing. And I'm like, oh, I'm actually using my MA. Wow.
Nice.
Which they did tell us when we were doing it. They're like, this is a vocational degree. However... Right. Not all of you will enter the vocation. So yeah, I did an MA in creative writing. It was 2009, and there were not a lot of jobs out there. So I thought it was a good idea to go and study some more. Yeah, and then I wrote while I was in Japan. I used to write for a website called Tofugu, which kind of a Japanese culture and language learning website. Had a lot of fun writing for them. And then I do write fiction. I've had like one short story published by a magazine that shortly went out of business, unfortunately, like 2 issues later, which is very sad. But like that's actually something that I really want. Like now I've kind of got my feet under me. I'm feeling pretty confident with my like TTRPG stuff. I am like getting back into writing my own fiction because most like the kind of work that I do, I am usually not writing my own stuff. Like right. I am not. I am supporting other people's ideas, which I really love. Like I love collaborating with people. It's super fun. And like where you just like go off on a wild creative tear and kind of discuss the like how this giant meteor crater will impact the local like fauna and flora of this magical world or whatever. But it is mostly kind of me helping other people's stuff shine. And so yeah, I want to kind of spend some more time on my own things as well, which. Is sort of less in the TTRPG, more in the kind of fiction arena, which they are very different styles of writing. And it's been really like, hard getting my head back into fiction after being in TTRPG. I'm like, what do you mean I have to write conclusions? What? No, other people will end the story.
Absolutely. So I used to write... ages ago. I used to do everything ages ago. I'm sure everyone on listens to this podcast is like, what haven't you done, Devin? I used to write like a lot of slice of life articles and stuff like that. So when I started writing like books, I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I mean, they aren't bad, but they're not good either. I can definitely see that I was still playing D&D when I was writing them. Let's just put it that way. But now I'm looking to get back into it with bits and pieces. But I have no intention of technically marketing that to the tabletop industry. Although there's so many of us that love fiction and everything else, and there's so many readers in this community, so nice little crossover. But like I don't even know. I realized that I immediately sat down and started building the world like I was gonna run a campaign in it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I need to get out of that. I'm not entirely sure how to do that yet, but I'm working on it. What genre do you write in?
I mostly science fiction, fantasy, horror. Mm-hmm. That's my my happy place. Like if I wanted to read about someone living a normal life, I'm just like, no, I'm just going to go live my own normal life.
Right.
That's ever since I was a kid, I'm like, this doesn't have any magic in it. I don't.
Yeah.
I like things with a bit of something weird. Something's got to be a little bit odd.
Right.
Yeah. That's my happy place.
Do you have anything published or anything else?
I have one short story published in the aforementioned magazine that folded, which I think is still online. It's in across genres. Mm-hmm. It's called the Springwood Home for Genetically Modified Animals, which is about a genetically modified animal shelter.
Right. So I see the line with Humblewood very easily there.
Yeah, there's strange and dark goings on at the genetically modified animal shelter.
So out of curiosity, would Hit Point Press publish anything in that kind of, I don't know if there's things that they just no, we don't go for horror.
I don't think. We're not really set up as a traditional book publisher.
Wrote it into a setting.
Oh, if I wrote it into a setting, if it worked, yeah.
Oh, okay,
we've often. I don't think there's anything that's really off limits for us. We have a Hecna is our horror carnival setting. Uh-huh. It's pretty gruesome. I think it has a not for children under 14 warning on it.
Okay.
There's evil parasitic clown noses in it. It's pretty creepy.
Right.
I don't think there's although we're known for Humblewood and the kind of cute little animals.
Right.
Our other projects are not necessarily all in the kind of family friendly cute kind of vein. Right. It's pretty, as I said, it's whatever we makes us say hell yeah.
So I wasn't sure. I was like, wait a minute, what? This totally sounds like the dark side of Humblewood.
Yeah.
And then I was like, would they do that? Well, that's good to know, because if there's if I ever decide to put my dark setting into a campaign.
we have occasionally joked about Crumblewood, which is a post-apocalyptic Humblewood.
Oh, I'm here for it.
Yeah.
Let's do some Mad Max shit with Humblewood.
Yeah, Mad Max, little hedgehogs just going wild.
Oh, I'm here for it. Absolutely. I'm apparently getting a delivery. My house talks to me. I don't know if you heard that in the background.
No.
Okay, good. I'm visually impaired. So when there's movement or anything else around my house alerts me.
And that's nice of your house. That's very
it
cool.
Is. The funny thing is, it almost always happens when I'm recording an episode. Mm-hmm. And normally everyone can hear it, but I kind of threw myself in front of the mic hoping I could block it a little.
Well, I didn't pick it up.
Sweet. Okay, good. This way I can just edit it out in case it did come up, but... Mm. Yeah, so my house is like, someone is by the front door. Thank you.
Thank you, house.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't need you to tell me this right now, and there's no way for me to set it on mute because I won't remember. Mm. I won't turn it back on. And then I have no idea that anything's going on around my house. It tells me other things, not just mm-hmm. people around my house. So
that is makes very cool.
Easier. Yeah. Makes life much easier for me, so... And I've stopped annoying my poor wife, who has to deal with the fact that I don't turn lights on. And numerous other weird things that apparently normal-sighted people don't have to worry about, but I do, so.
Yeah, this is the stuff that AI should be doing.
Absolutely. I mean, technically, it is. This is one of the reasons why, I've I had Joey Hake on here. Mm-hmm. And because he came to me with the idea, he's like, you know, knowing, because he's been over my house and my house, mm-hmm. you know, he's talked to my house. And he was like, wow, this is, you know, pretty neat and everything else. And his partner at the time was like, oh, you know, that's so fancy. And I was like, yeah, that's great. I'm not doing it to be fancy. I'm doing it to like not walk into furniture and just make life a little bit easier. And so we were talking about it and he was like, you know, he's like, I know that you are absolutely very pro, you know, tools like this and everything else. And he's like, how do you feel about it as an artist? And I was like, to be honest with you, I would love to be able to type in something because like I can't draw. I don't see in three dimension mm-hmm. because I essentially am blind in one eye. So I have no depth perception. So this makes drawing certain things in perspective almost impossible for me. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, it'd be amazing to like just type in a prompt and have something that can give me like a really good reference of what I'm looking for in the perspective I want and use this as a reference. And I can't do that because I don't want to, you know, like even if I'm not taking that art and putting my name on it and pretending that I made it, because that's what I think that they're doing.
Yeah. Those darn moral principles.
Right. So, yeah. But I mean, you know, and even though I'm just using a reference, I still credit anybody's work mm-hmm. who I use as a reference. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like a huge thing for me. And it's one of the things that when working with other companies, if you give me a reference for somebody, it will not look like that at all. like the closest we're going to get is like the land features are in the correct spots, but that's about it. I will never give you something that looks like what you gave me a reference for because I won't copy somebody's art even a little, mm-hmm. you know?
And so, like, I love the idea of crediting references because it's like, thank you to the people who made these awesome references. Like we had, it was one of the minis that Victoria made and she had found a reference photo of Errol Flynn from the film Captain Blood. And this guy, it was like some guy had it in his private collection and had written up this like classic old school blog post about like all of these promotional photos from Captain Blood. And the reason I know this is because when I was like posting Victoria's kind of write up of her her sculpting process onto the Patreon, I was like, oh, this is a really cool photo. I'm going to go find out where this is from. And so I asked her and she directed me to the site. I'm like, this is amazing. Like, this is really cool article here. And so we linked it. Like we used the photo, like with, like, here's the like link to where you can learn all about this awesome photo. Because like, yeah, like if you want to know more, where do you go? And like, if people are out there feeling like they can share stuff, I think it is better for everyone. We all get more cool stuff. I'm really worried about like a contracting of people like sharing their cool thing because AI is just going to come along and scrape it and take it and do its kind of dastardly deeds with it.
Absolutely. And so many of us in the art community have already seen like a tremendous decline and in the amount of people that are sharing and the amount of, and a lot of the newer artists coming out and asking like what to do and what we have for tools. And although there's things like Glaze and new websites coming out, I think it's the newest one is Card, I think is the name of it. Coming out to replace websites that absolutely don't care if they're using AI. Even though all of this is coming out and it's kind of a scary time for a lot of us because we don't know what our future looks like, at the same time, I think that if we stop, it's just going to make everything worse.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
They win, right?
Yeah.
Things just stall out. Like it's we just end up consuming endless returned regurgitated kind of gunk from AI.
Exactly, you know. And so again, I'm going to stress, as artists, put your logo on everything, put your URL on everything, put in a place where if they crop it out, it looks really weird, or use things like Glaze, absolutely research. Google has tons of stuff, or just ask other artists on socials. We are more than happy to point you in a direction to keep your artwork off of any AI machines.
Yeah, it's also really frustrating when you go looking for artists. This is the kind of the other side of it. I back on the Big Bads project, I would often go and like try and find like artists we hadn't worked with before and see who's out there. And basically all of the big kind of like portfolio kind of conglomeration sites just became useless almost overnight. And it was just like, oh, nuts. Now we have to be like so much more careful when we're like approaching people and we're like, hey, it's like, are there like process images on people's sites? Like that's one of the things we look for now.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's like, yeah, like, can we actually see how you got to where, got to the finished product? Because like it would be heartbreaking if we just like made the wrong call and like someone gave us AI when we don't want to use it. It's just,
or you ignore somebody, you know, who because you can't quite tell, because you know, it is hard to tell with certain things. It's not exactly like everything is automatic. There you go, artists. There's a good reason to put your work in progress, videos showing what you do, stuff like that. See, this is the other reason why I started doing them recently. Like I was, it's just me recording my screen because I can never show my entire screen to people. One, because there's always something that's an NDA going on. But the other thing is because I have found that it's just easier for me than trying to like set up the software to record whatever part of the screen to whatever, you know, and then do the editing. I was like, here's just my phone. I'm lazy. And, but yeah, I also started doing it because I became painfully aware of how many people that I know aren't AI artists who are being accused of it. And I was like, no, that's a real person.
Yeah.
Like I've literally watched them create stuff, you know, but after finding out that an actual well-known artist painted over someone else's work anyhow, or used AI to finish something, I was like, well, maybe I shouldn't say anything because thanks, you know, just make our job even harder. That's awesome.
Yeah. heavy sigh.
Yeah. How do you, like, I can't even imagine what that conversation is like with asking somebody if they use AI, because how do you not feel like you're insulting somebody who doesn't use it?
Yeah, like, I thankfully, I don't think it's come up for us, at least to my knowledge. Like, I've not seen anything like that. But yeah, like, I think it has had the unfortunate like effect of just making everyone like less trusting, I guess. Like it's just with our process, especially with art, it's pretty like we ask for sketches, they fix the sketches, like we give feedback. Like it's a pretty back and forth process, and I don't know if you could do that with AI. I don't think so at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know.
I would hope. Maybe I'm naive. But yeah, like I'm hoping we'll never have to have that conversation. But yeah, that would be pretty rough. And like with writing, I worry about that as well. Like at the moment, I don't think most of the like AI large language models are quite at the level where they're churning out like decent technical TTRPG writing. but like it potentially could. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know how we're gonna deal with that, because it's like we're not teachers, like we're not here looking right. for like running things through plagiarism software or like going into someone's Google Doc and looking at their like full history of like how they like created the thing and like edited the thing. Yeah. And I don't want to have to do that. I have lots of other things that I would rather be like that my time is better spent doing.
Right.
So I really hope that it doesn't come to that. But yeah, as I said, it's like I do genuinely think everyone is creative. Like everyone, even people who say they're not creative, I genuinely think everyone's creative because it's just like a human trait. Right. But it just makes me really sad when people. Like that some people are taking that creative energy and just putting it into this rather than actually getting the enjoyment of creating something themselves. I don't get it. Like it just seems weird to me.
Right.
I
kind of do, because I had somebody years and years ago. I had somebody who's really interesting. This person is a psychologist that I was friends with. And we were talking about the very odd way that some people react to finding out that you're an artist. Mm. Like some people like, oh my God, that is so amazing. What do you do? Like they get all excited and they want to see your stuff or, you know, but some people seem very like, meh. Do you have a real job? You know? Oh, thanks. Yeah. You know, but we were talking about it and he was like, yeah, he's like, one of the most interesting things about it is how many people would absolutely love to be an artist, would do anything to feel like they are creative on that little level, to make something out of thin air, to, you know, so much so that because he actually works with a he does forensic, he essentially looks through somebody's testimony and everything else, and he's looking for like changes in speech and body language and behavioral sciences. And he goes through his whole thing. And the interesting thing is like he'll turn around and he's like, you know, he's like the fact that people will lie about being an artist, lie about creating something, lie about coming up with an idea, lie about being the person who invented it, just to portray themselves as like this incredibly brilliant and talented creative person, you know, and it almost always falls apart because it doesn't show in anything else that they do, you know. But it is the biggest reason why people steal art or forge art.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, the kind of like the status and the prestige. But then I'm just like, but you spend all this energy.
Right, no, 100%.
You could just do something yourself. But I wonder if it's just like people doubt themselves and their like ability to actually do it. It's easier to steal from someone else and right. then if that gets criticized, it's not really criticizing you.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's a little bit of distance there. And cause it is kind of vulnerable to put yourself out creatively, like to open yourself up. And that's kind of why it's wonderful, right? Like we get to like peer into other people's heads.
Right.
It's basically magic.
I think that a lot of people are I don't want to say lazy about it, but I think that they don't want to put in the work that's involved because it is a lot of work. I mean, especially if you want to do it for a living. It isn't. I wish that I could spend my days just doing nothing but drawing, but unfortunately, there's so much else involved.
Yeah, like I have a lot of meetings about dragons. I also have a lot of meetings about spreadsheets and numbers and things that are not dragons. Yeah, like it is, it's still a job. There's still like, there's long days where you're just like, at the end, you're just like, my brain is a puddle.
Right. And then trying to learn to create, I think for a lot of people, the idea of learning how to draw or putting in that time is terrifying because it takes a lot. And even when you're a professional artist and you do it for a living, you still doubt your own ability.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, even when I look back at things that I've written or even that I've edited, I'm always thinking like, I could have done better. It doesn't go away. And you just have to get over it because otherwise you just like get lost in a kind of maelstrom of self-doubt, which is not terribly helpful. But yeah, it is pretty tough, I think.
Yeah, I just think I think it's very interesting that instead of putting all that time and effort into actually, you know, being the very thing that they want to be, they'd rather steal it. And then there's no way you're not going to be caught.
Mm-hmm.
Although right now I watched a very interesting conversation unfold on social media where somebody is very proud to be an AI artist.
Mm.
And it was really strange because not only were they overly defensive over it, but the way that they talked about how, you know, they justified how it's not stealing to them, how it's, you know, not a big deal. And and they actually wrote something that was essentially like, well, the artist already got paid for it. And I'm like, how would you fucking know that?
Yeah.
it's not like we're just over here like I only produce things that I'm paid for. That's not how art works.
The internet is not a machine that you put art into and money comes out of,
right? So I'm like, no, that's the point. We're not being compensated for it, and half the time if we are, it's usually not adequately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you want to build things, build your own things.
Right.
Like it's just so weird.
Right. Make your own. Like, there are so many, like, a perfect example is, you know, I got tagged. If you make anything of my art, like if you use one of my maps as a reference, I will be tagged in it. I will absolutely be tagged in it. But I will be tagged if anyone's art looks even close to mine. And usually it's not close enough for me to ever worry, but I did have, at one point I was tagged in somebody's art and it looked like mine.
Hmm.
Like it was terrifyingly close. And I honestly thought that it was better. And I wanted to absolutely promote this other artist because I loved what they did. And then I realized that they were copying parts of the maps I already made, specifically for Critical Role. And then was implying that they will make a Critical Role map for them, for people. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't promote you. Because what you're doing is essentially, and I saw some of the other stuff that they did, and of course, like, they're doing copyrighted IPs, and I was like, you can't do that. Like, I don't know if you know this or not.
Just IP as a, like, concept in TTRPGs is something that I think about a lot, because of the work that I do and that I've done, like taking care of other people's IPs is such an honor and a privilege. And so it's just like, oh, you're letting me come in here and like play with your toys, basically. I get kind of riled up if I see, like, fan stuff is great, I love it, but when it's taking the parts of something that, like, people have worked on and just kind of using it to profit, like, that's not cool.
No, not at all. I have to ask, where are you from? Because your accent sounds so familiar.
So I am from the UK. Okay. Specifically, I was born in Cambridge. But I haven't lived in the UK since 2011. Okay. So my accent has gotten kind of weird.
Yeah.
To the extent that when I go home, I was in a shop, like, in the village that I, like, was born and grew up in and, like, lived until I was 18. And someone asked me, where are you from? And I was like, I'm from here. And they were like, no, not where do you live, where are you from? And I was like, no, I'm from here. I was born in the hospital over there. I lived over there.
It almost sounds British, but I can't place it.
My like Verity Lane is my like professional name,
right?
And my like personal name is still Verity. Verity's my real name, and it's still got Lane in there. But it also has we double barreled my husband's surname and my surname, and his surname is like so Scandinavian, Scandinavian right. to the max, and so people. So frequently will like they hear the accent and they're like, oh, okay, this person has a weird accent, okay, but she's speaking English pretty well, so, and her surname is Scandinavian, and right. then they'll go, so are you from Norway or Sweden? And I'm like, no, I'm not. People like they always think I'm from Scandinavia and that English is my second language.
Well, I could tell it was your first, so. Yeah. But I can also tell that you speak other languages. You have to.
Yeah, I do speak Japanese, although I'm definitely rusty. Mm-hmm. When I was living there and working at the embassy, but oh my goodness, I've forgotten way too much of it, which I'm kind of mad about. I'm like I need to study up. It's a little bit harder.
Right.
Like not although my like big boss the like CEO of the company is actually like on a trade mission in Japan at the moment, which is pretty cool. So I'm like, ooh, yes, Humblewood Japanese translation when?
Right, I'm here for it. I can do this. Yeah,
I did. I got to look at the 5e the SRD in Japanese, which was pretty fun. Because we were making like a Japanese exclusive one of our animated cards, and I was like, oh, I get to like look at Eldritch Blasto. I'm like, yeah, this is so cool.
It's got to look more foreign in another language, because like with the familiarity that you have with it, and then to see it like the non-English format of other languages.
Yeah, like because like. My reading of Japanese is like it's fine for right. getting by and like living in Japan, but I'm not like reading the newspaper. I'm reading little children's books, not grown-up books. Right. But because when I was reading it, because I know like 5e so well, I could be like, oh, okay, I can, from context clues, I can guess that this is, like, duration and time, right. And like, which is kind of fun to, like, see how, like, it's like, oh, that's the kanji for spell. I would never have guessed.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.